Today is the 6th of June, 1981, and by a wonderful coincidence, it's exactly 20 years since Carl Gustav Jung died at the age of 85. So my topic today is Jung's life and work, and I would like very much to read from the biography what happened just before he died and to tell you how he wrote the book that is in the bookstore, Man and His Symbols, and to tell you about his life and work. So in a sense, it's a memorial to Carl Gustav Jung, whom I consider the foremost psychiatrist, a co-worker of Freud who pioneered beyond Freud, and whose religious emphasis has drawn me to him, because he said, we cannot become whole unless we have a spiritual center and make a spiritual commitment. He himself is a son of a whole group of Protestant pastors. He grew up in Switzerland, and his father was a prominent pastor in Küsnacht in Zurich, Switzerland. He grew up in a typically strict Protestant home and was a very serious, inquisitive, and brilliant young man. He spent a lot of time wondering about why we act the way we do, why he felt the way he did. He had a very analytic bent of mind, and hopefully today or tomorrow, or rather Monday, we will understand what kind of a type, personality type he was. He was introspective and an introvert. incidentally, he coined the word introversion and extroversion, which of course have become common terms. He did his psychiatric work at the very famous clinic in Switzerland, and worked with schizophrenic people and with disturbed persons of all kinds, and always came to them face to face, so to speak, and looked at their center, the treasure that we all carry within us. And he didn't go by labels, and that's one of the things I like about him. He didn't say, oh, now I'm working with a schizophrenic. Well, you know how that is. Then you have a mindset. He cleared himself and said, here's a human being who's troubled, and I'll see if I cannot make him feel worthwhile and better about himself. And I myself am a therapist. I try to follow his example and to look at each person as a child of God who's carrying this priceless treasure in an earthen vessel, and to remind each person that God has a special destiny for them, and to bring out the God-given gifts that he was given, and to help him realize his potential. As you know from my previous sessions, he felt dreams were very important. Dreams were very important, if not essential, for understanding the unconscious, and that the unconscious had a lot of power for good, for creativity, and not just sexual energy as Freud postulated. That's where they made their difference. In addition to being a great scholar, he wrote 17 works, 17 volumes in German. He spoke fluent English. He would lecture in English and people would marvel at his fluency. He also loved to work with his hands. In other words, he was a scholar, and he was also a person who could work with his hands, and especially with stone. And he built in his near his house in Bollingen, he built a round tower, stone by stone. He also carved a stone with many vital inscriptions. He felt he wanted something for posterity. And above his door, he carved the words in Latin. I will translate. Vocatus atque non vocatus, Deus aderit. Whether we call on God or not, he is always present. So that was his motto. this has acquired a new meaning for me too. I hope you can see this picture. I said he loved to sit by the water and look like a farmer. If you can see this, I'll pass the book around later. He looked just like a farmer sitting there with a straw hat. And now on the other side, we see the scholar going through all the books, and he was equally at home in both worlds. He was an excellent psychotherapist or analyst, and he was a gourmet chef, a stonemason, a wonderful friend, lecturer, all-around kind of person, and deeply religious. When he was interviewed by John Freeman, he was asked, "Do you believe in God?" He was about 80 at that time. He leaned forward and he said, "No, I don't believe. I know." It was beautiful. Maybe this sounds heretical. He went to say he was so certain of his belief. He didn't mean to say he didn't believe. He felt so certain of his belief. He worked on many aspects, of some of which I have touched upon, and I will talk about one aspect today after I read a brief description of the last days that he was here, and also how he wrote this book, Man and His Symbols. Mostly he worked with anyone who came to see him, but he always liked to work with people who were well-educated and who could understand his work. Even though his German was difficult, he loved intellectual discussions. And in his 84th year, he was approached by John Freeman to write this book, Man and His Symbols. And he said, "I'm old. No, I don't want to do it." And that night he had a dream, and you'll see it when the reading as well. He had a dream which he stood on a platform, and many uneducated people were standing there listening to him and understood what he said. And he sat down and he wrote this article that's in this book in English and finished it like 10 days before he died. So with this introduction, I'll read. The book that I have here is his life and work by Barbara Hanna, who was his co-worker, who's still alive, I believe. She was analyzed by him. I think she's still alive, about 76 or 78 years old, I'm not sure. actually, I have to find the place, just a minute. He had been writing the book, the article for Man and His Symbols in English. And he worked at minor alteration for some weeks, but it became evident that his physical health was really giving out. He still saw a few people, went for drives, and the last drive we took together, May 6th, exactly a month before his death, he did not walk at all, although it had been his invariable habit until then. He also did not feel like talking, though he seemed anxious to see his favorite roads, and we drove longer than usual. On the last drive, we were held up three times by weddings, and Jung, being very aware of opposites, seemed to be to make a remark as to the fact that weddings were a good omen, but underneath was also understood that the next big thing is a funeral, you see. Jung was out only once after this drive, for a drive in his own car. About 3 weeks before his death, he had a slight stroke which blurred his speech a little, but did not otherwise lame him in any way. He moved about the second floor. His library, his bedroom, and a large balcony were on the same floor until Tuesday, May 30th, exactly a week before he died. He even did some writing. Then he had another slight stroke, and he had to leave his library for good. He was just 1 week in bed, remained conscious to the end. His last visions were largely concerned with the future of the world after his death. He told his friends the last time they saw him that he had a vision in which a large part of the world was destroyed, but he added, "Thank God, not all of it." His last recorded dreams were recorded by another friend who wrote them to me, the author of the book. One, here are the last dreams that Jung had. He saw a big round block of stone in a high bare place. On it was inscribed, "This shall be a sign unto you of wholeness and oneness." And those who were in my other sessions remember, I spoke of round a circle as a sign of wholeness. A second brief dream was a series of vessels and pottery on the right side of a square place. Squareness, quaternity is another sign of wholeness. And the final one, a square of trees with the fibrous roots coming from the ground surrounding him. There were gold threads gleaming among the roots. This very beautiful last dream in which Jung's unity and wholeness are confirmed she explains, the pots in a square at the right, where remember that in ancient Egypt some parts of the god Osiris were kept in pots because it was from them that the resurrection was expected to take place. The pots in the soil also represent the underworld and the seed of the dead waiting for resurrection. Jung died at 4:15 on Tuesday afternoon, June 6th, 1961. There were again some synchronistic events that had occurred previously. I remember most vividly that when I went to fetch my car, just before he died, I found the battery that was not old, completely run down and dead, which puzzled me. But when she told me an hour later, it seemed like a natural omen. However, there were no thunderstorms at the time he died, although it was reported so from time to time. But about 2 hours later, a lightning struck a tall poplar tree in the garden at the edge of the lake. And this was unusual because the water usually attracts lightning. The tree was not destroyed, only a great deal of bark was stripped off. In fact, it was discovered by the family a few hours later. Jung said of death and his memories, "Death is a fearful piece of brutality. There's no sense in pretending otherwise. It is brutal not only physically, but far more psychically." However, Jung died so exactly at the right time that his death was such a natural event that when we were able to pull ourselves together and pull our own lives together, we found that I had been wondering how far his pupils would endure his death and be able to stand on their own feet. I'm sure we should have felt his death far more brutal had he died earlier. As it was, though it was terribly painful, I realized how vividly he had prepared us and how well Jung himself had taught us to stand on our own feet. At the end, I could only say thank you again and again, because I still feel that this life, which was lived so fully, that we were privileged to know, and I felt a profound and boundless gratitude. I wanted to share this with you since this day happened to be the 20th anniversary of the death of this great man. Earlier I said I'd read to you how he felt about the writing of the book and about the book writing Man and His Symbols. He said, explaining his psychology to people who knew nothing about psychology was very difficult for him. I remember when I first came to Zurich, he told me that he had to send those people who knew little or nothing to one of his colleagues because he didn't have the patience. But when he was asked to give 3 lectures during the war to the inhabitants of Küsnacht, where he lived, he told me it gave him more trouble than any of his other lectures. Yet, having realized from his dream that there was a multitude of people who could understand his psychology, he never hesitated and put himself to the endless trouble to explain his fundamental points as simply as possible and to write it in the English language, so we have this. And he finished it before he died. How many of you have bought the book or read the book so far? Anybody? Or the first chapter? Well, I hope that you'll find some points in it that are of help. Yes?
It's going to be on reserve in the library.
Oh, good. Already? Oh, all right. Well, those who wanted it got it early. All right. So it'll be on reserve in there. But I will talk about it and take it point by point next week in one of the talks. Okay. Now, I myself have read his works and been mostly fascinated by his work on dreams. And I've talked about dreams in three other sessions. Today I'd like to talk about his typology, extroversion and introversion, as well as the functions of the conscious life. It will help you to understand your spouse, your friends, and people you don't like, can't get along with. And my husband can testify to the fact that after 29 years of marriage, I still can't decide what kind of a type he is. We don't stay put, you know, we change. But basically, our predisposition remains the same. First, the division between introversion and extroversion. Contrary to the stereotype, the introvert isn't the lonely soul that sits in the library and doesn't speak to anyone. The introvert may be wonderful with people, may be very well adjusted in the world. The key to understanding the introvert is where the energy comes from. And how much time he likes to be alone. 'Tis true, he prefers, is happier, recharges in his solitude, and is out with people as an expression of his solitude. The extrovert, on the other hand, works with people or with things. He may be a geologist, a carpenter, electrician. He's in the world, he works with things and people perhaps. And is happiest and spends most of his energy and is recharged in the world, and I don't mean in a derogatory term, in the outside events, and goes into himself merely to, I would say, change his clothes. You see? So, do not think that the introvert is that lonely loner. The loner is a maladjusted person. Also, there is no value judgment. We need introverts, we need extroverts. Our culture, however, rewards the extrovert extraordinarily and kind of frowns on the introvert. By and large, artists, writers are introverts, but it says nothing how much they enjoy being with people or get along with people. People in the helping professions, mostly, I'd say, more introverted than extroverted. Extroverted people are the more traditionally, give me an example. What do you think is a good extrovert? Huh?
Stewardess.
Yeah, stewardess. I think actor. Actors have to be extroverted. How about politicians? I think a politician is the best example of an extrovert.
Are preachers extroverts?
Hard to say. What do you think, Mary?
Me?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
I know some of both.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. That's what I hoped you would say. I think they come from two places. There's some, I would say the pastor who deals, you know, is out there and is able to get projects and get money for his church. Gets all the big churches. It's more extroverted. And the one who preaches the very powerful sermons, in other words, that comes from a deep understanding and study. That doesn't mean the other person doesn't make good sermons, but you know what I'm saying, is more introverted. But they are both kinds. As I say, it's hard to know. Yeah? Did you have a question? Oh. Now, that's just the beginning. Everybody is sometimes extroverted, sometimes introverted. By and large, young people are extroverted. They have to make decisions about jobs, about marriage, and have to deal with the outside world more than their inner feelings. If they go into themselves too much, spend too much time, often it is a maladjustment, or it is only well adjusted if they are in the artistic field, because then they have to be in touch with the unconscious. In the second half of life, it is our duty and our task to get acquainted with the inner life, and this helps us let go of the outer world, and in a sense prepares us for death too. So that, he says, the good balance is to be more extroverted in youth and more introverted in old age. However, there is a predisposition that some are more introverted to begin with, you see. And there are degrees, and each person has a unique destiny and works it out in a unique way. So everyone is some of both, but primarily and more comfortably in one mode of adjustment than in the other. Now, we have always to remember that the conscious, which is the ego, and the unconscious, which he calls the collective unconscious, are in opposition and complement one another, complement one another. All right? So, again, if your ego is very outgoing, extroverted, your unconscious will bring up a lot of introverted things. If your predisposition is introverted, your consciousness will be extroverted. So much for that. Now, he talked about persons who are primarily rational and persons who are primarily non-rational. Not irrational, but non-rational. Now, you all know the person who sits is thinking and value-oriented, who plans his life, is orderly, is logical, is non-impulsive, pragmatic, and who seems to be able to handle irrational things by processing them through thought process. I must think about this first is exactly what I'm trying to say. Somebody asks you a question, they will often retort by, well, let me think about it, which is a very good answer, but it's typical of a thinking type person, okay? Now, a feeling type person is one who makes judgments, but says, this is good. If you ask him something, he'll say, well, this is nice, or this is good, or this is bad. And many of us, I think, here at Holden are primarily feeling type persons because we say this is good, or we're here because we have made a value judgment about life and we want to share these values with like-minded people. When you hear somebody saying this is good, this is bad, this is nice, they're often expressing a feeling. It has nothing to do with emotions. Feelings are value judgments. You say, here's what you say, I have to think about it, this is a good idea, and so forth. That's more thinking-oriented. Now, these are just one type of person. We either extrovert or introverted. The other kind is non-rational. Most artists fall in that category. You have the intuitive, and you have the sensation-oriented or practically oriented. The intuitive person goes by a hunch and follows the impulse. Giving into impulses with a good check or with good values is a very healthy thing. If you repress your impulses totally, you're holding too tight a control over the non-rational side. Remember, everything has to sort of balance out. And the intuitive person will have a hunch or an idea or a feeling and will go with it. Will also be attracted by the occult sometimes, or by astrology, and young people are often, we talk of them as being more impulsive, and they're often more, today in our society, more permissive about giving into impulses than our generation was. We had a stricter control of all impulses or intuitions. Some of the phrases we use, I have to get my, well, how does it go? I have to get my act together? No. Yeah. It means like bringing in all these stray pieces, and I'm not going to follow every hunch. I'm going to bring everything together. And when we feel distraught, it is that we have let too much of ourselves go out here and there and have followed too many different possibilities. I think sometimes we get too carried away and too spread too thinly if we follow every possibility that presents itself. It takes the rational judgment, again, to decide which way to go and what to do and how to use our God-given talents. Now, the practical sensation type is the one I understand least, and I'll try to explain what that person is like. Is the good housekeeper, the person who keeps track of money, who is able to be here and now and deal with one step at a time. And it's a very balancing thing for an intuitive to train his sensation function, which he has, so that he can do one thing at a time. And I'll confess, when I first started doing housework, started the breakfast, plugged in the vacuum, started the laundry, ran all over, and I had 20 things going and didn't finish nothing. So the thing to do is to start one and finish it, to do one thing after another. For me, this is difficult. For a practical sensation type, this is the way he operates. And he, the sensation person, would have difficulty with letting a few loose ends hang or following hunches. And we can talk about this later. I see you're nodding. And when you have kids, I think you face that right on, don't you? I would like to go into more detail on this type, on his typology next time when we talk. I'd like to go on to talk about some other things that he worked with. It's already 4:30. I mentioned as I came in that it's synchronistic that today happens to be the anniversary of his death. Synchronicity is almost synonymous with coincidence. It's a non-causal relationship. It's another word and another concept he worked with. Synchronicity, S-Y-N, shall I write it on the board? Syn means together, and chronicity comes from time. Two things happen at the same time, but they are not causally connected, at least not in the way we can clearly see. But I'm sure it happens at Holden all the time, and Mary gave a beautiful example yesterday of the man who built model airplanes, and it just happened that the playground needed a man with model airplanes. Well, they didn't know that they had somebody there. This was a synchronistic event, and I feel God has something to do with that, brings it about so that these things happen. And they always make us stop, catch our breath, and say, oh, wasn't that marvelous? Praise the Lord, you know? And I find that those things are like planted there for us to feel grateful and realize that there's a plan that we really cannot fathom, that's much larger than we understand, that everything is connected. Everything works together for good for those that love God. And when synchronicities occur, they're evidence that God loves us. So when you have these happenings, be grateful, don't be scared. It is shocking sometimes. And when it happens that, for example, some people dream that some close friend dies, and then sure enough they get the news that this person died, it is upsetting, but you already then find that this person has had psychic powers and would have probably intuited and known this event. It just happened that he was sensitive and it came to him in a dream. He might have noticed this or felt this in another way, just as Barbara Hanna noticed that her battery went dead and connected it with Jung's death. And there was no cause there, you see. And you can be sensitive to this you can be sensitive to this phenomenon, or you can discount it. I liken it to small miracles, really, and they're happening all the time.